Welcome to States and Migration in Europe. In this episode, we will dive deep into European migration law, focusing on the essential principle of free movement within the European Union. There is an increasing debate about migration within Europe, and therefore we explore this principle of free movement that applies to EU citizens and how it relates to the rest of EU migration law. Joining us is a top expert of European migration law, Professor Daniel Tain, who has just published a book on the topic with Oxford University Press. It was published in 2023. Professor Tain brings unparalleled insights into the complexities of migration law, current challenges, and the current context. So, Professor Tain, Daniel, welcome.
Thank you, Emmanuel, for having me.
So, today's discussion is structured to provide some understanding of the extent to which free movement is still an important element in European migration law. That is, the EU was formed as around the principle of the single market from the 1950s onwards, and this principles included the principle of free movement for people. Since about 40 years, there has been a development of EU regulations on third country nationals, that is, people who are not nationals from the EU, and there the principle of free movement is much less important. So let's dive deep into this topic, and try to assess to what extent free movement is still an important element in European migration law. First, Daniel, how did you come to study these topics of European migration law?
I was an expert of EU studies, EU law first, but then I decided to become a professor. And as a German professor, you have to write books to get the professorship. And I decided to write my second book on migration and asylum. And then came 2015, 2016, where not only in Germany, but across Europe, migration and asylum became one of the big salient topics everyone is talking and discussing about. And ever since, I have not left the field. To the contrary, I delve ever deeper in it, and I discover a lot of fascinating small issues, but also the broader picture remains really fascinating and very important for our societies and for our politics, because asylum in particular can be a poisonous topic which poisons the political debate, also between member states.
Yes. I have not understood. Did you move to migration law before or after the 2015 events?
I wrote the book. I finished the book in 2010. It was published in 2010. So I moved into migration and asylum long before. But
At that moment, why did you move there?
Because I thought it was a fascinating, important new topic. It was not so much about asylum at the time, but Germany, everyone told us we have so-called demographic change, which means we are an aging society. So it's predictable that in 5, 10, 20 years from now, Germany just needs migration to survive as a country, as an economy. And that will be the case with many European countries. The population is aging in the east of the continent, in the south. So we need migration, and it's really challenging how to organize it.
Interesting. Yeah. There's this notion of Germany will need more migrants, and so you thought that it's an important public problem. And as a EU lawyer, you decided to move towards this particular topic, and then became so much important in the media landscape. And you are a lawyer, so how do you study those topics? What are your research methods?
I sit in libraries, I sit at my desks, I read books, I read judgments, I read legislation, and mostly that's done with PDF files and the internet nowadays. So I'm not going out there at the border to talk to people. I mean, I do so occasionally, but I do so indirectly by reading judgments where intelligent people, judges, lawyers, and others have contributed to resolving specific legal issues. So it's a very condensed form of encountering the empirics, the factual situation on the ground through the lens of judgments. But that can be very useful because, as I said, very intelligent people have contributed to this judgment on all sides. So it's a fascinating angle to analyze it.
Yeah. So let's dive deep now into the core of the matter. That is, perhaps it's my... I am from French background. Now I live in Greece. So perhaps I have some influence from both Descartes and Plato. And so I'm thinking, when you have a body of legislation like European migration law, what is the soul of this body? What is the deep core? For an English audience, it may be perhaps less obvious that we need to have such a structure in migration law, because British law and English law have been produced on an ad hoc basis by case law. But if we take this assumption that there is some spirit, we can talk about Hegel as well, there is some spirit of the law, or Montesquieu, what is the deep spirit of European migration law? Would you say that the principle of free movement is still a cornerstone of European migration law?
It's definitely essential. It's a crucial perspective in many respects. But my very general answer would be, it depends on whom you ask. I mean, European migration law is the outcome of a very rich and lively political debate between national governments, between the Council of Ministers and the European Parliament. And they all have different views, also what the core and the main mission is. So in a way, it's typically European. It's a compromise of different perspectives. But free movement is definitely a very central axis of all this. And my academic hometown, Konstanz, it's in the south of Germany. It's right on the Swiss border. Switzerland is not an EU member state, but they participate in free movement and they also participate in the Schengen area. So I experience on a daily basis what it means to cross European borders as a citizen. Some do it for work. I do it mainly for sport, leisure purposes, to meet friends and family. So it's really important to myself. And once you have that free movement within the European Union, in this case, including Switzerland, you must also deal with the other issues such as asylum and the like, because if you have free movement internally, you must have rules who is responsible for asylum, what happens to people who are granted asylum, who receive a positive decision, can they move to another country or not. So free movement is a very central perspective. But in the field of migration, the answer the politicians have given us is not so much people are allowed to move, it's more that they are not allowed to move. But the very fact that there is this answer has its basis in Schengen and free movement. So it's all connected.
Yeah, so as you say, and that's an important point of debate, that is, so there is free movement, there is a principle of free movement for the nationals of EU member states, plus you mentioned Switzerland as well. At the latest stage, I mean, the Swiss relation with the EU is an always evolving relationship, but you confirm it still applies on the ground.
Yes, the border is open. You can cross it. There is no fence. There was a fence during COVID, which was really a sort of traumatizing experience for people in my academic hometown and the neighboring Swiss town. There was a fence, and they put actually two fences so that you were not able to hug across the fence. But it's still a lived experience.
Yes. So, but when we talk about free movement, we talk not just about border crossing, we talk about the right of residence, the right to take up employment, to start a business, and so on and so forth. So, and you said that because we have free movement internally, you say we must have rules on, for instance, asylum. So there has been a differentiation between the European law on EU nationals, which is guided by the principle of free movement, and European migration law as it relates to people from outside the EU, outside Europe. So do you think that this system to allocate asylum seekers among EU member states, of to control the so-called EU's external borders, for instance, between Greece and Turkey or between Spain and Morocco, do you think that this body of law of control was made necessary by the principle of free movement inside Europe? Or is it something that came for other reasons? That is, you had restrictive forces inside European countries, and because they could not express themselves inside Europe as they were conflicting with the principle of free movement, they found their possibility of realization towards third country nationals. So, in a nutshell, is restriction the necessary complement of free movement, or is it something that is foreign, separate from free movement, and is not its consequence?
And if now by restriction you mean movements within the member states, so from Italy to Norway or Sweden, from Greece to Bulgaria, from Spain to France, and not from Morocco to Spain?
Both, because those movements for third country nationals are regulated, as you say. So both.
Yes. Okay, but then let's start maybe with the external borders, and then we can move inside.
Yeah. Okay.
Because the external border, you are the historian, not I am, but my reading of the Treaty of Rome is that at the time they were actually discussing, indirectly at least, the external borders between, because they decided deliberately that only nationals of the member states, EU citizens as we call them nowadays, would benefit from free movement, and that third country nationals would not benefit from it. At the time, it remained the prerogative of the member states to regulate these issues. But there was never a political consensus in Europe that free movement should be a worldwide experience by everyone. And at the time, it had to do much with the former colonies, of course, because there was at the time after the Second World War quite some movement from Africa, also from the Caribbean, especially to France, also to Belgium and the Netherlands. And it was decided that these people should not generally have free movement, which is also noted very critically by the more recent so-called post-colonial literature, which says that the European gave themselves free movement internally and they excluded the former colonies. So that has a long tradition, and that tradition was taken up in recent years. And then, of course, you can have a debate how open or closed the border should be. But I think the two things, that external restriction has always been separated from internal free movements. It's really two different issues which are somehow related to each other, but which we should maybe distinguish. And then you can have a very legitimate debate of how open or closed the external border should be. But the fact that we have internal free movement doesn't mean that the external border should be open or closed. I think that's really a separate discussion and issue.
Yes, absolutely. It was framed from the beginning that free movement applied to the nationals of the member states. But there was at the big question was, first of all, Europe was an evolving project, which would become the member states eventually. So the identity of the member states changed much. And you had also at the beginning this notion that two things. First, that even if a country was not strictly speaking a member state, it could have an association agreement, yes, that could include the principle of free movement as it was stated in European law. So you needed, so it was open-ended for this reason. So you had it with Greece, and you had it also with Turkey, which was never implemented. And then you had other countries, for instance, Tunisia, that tried to negotiate a similar agreement in later. So it was not clear until where the principle would go. So that's the first point. And the second point is that sometimes you had, so we mentioned that free movement includes various things, access to residents, first and foremost, but also access to labor market. It has also, even though it's not the core of free movement, some implication for social security transfers. And so you could have some elements of free movement that will be recognized to third country nationals. So it was not everything or nothing. It could be, the EU is often like that, open-ended. It has no clear borders generally. So how do you think that at some point they thought, no, we need to put clear borders as far as free movement is concerned? Mm-hmm. Yeah. They stopped this logic of open-ended expansion. And if so, was it to preserve internal free movement, which was my question, or was it for other reasons?
Yes, I don't mind if we disagree, but I actually agree with you that there is, as always, shades of gray. There is not this definite answer, and we have this association agreement. I mean, the case of Greece is an obvious example. In this case, it was also, well, a very first step towards later accession of Greece to the European Union. So in a way, offering free movement to countries such as Greece and others to a certain extent, at least, was a preparation for free movement. And the case of Switzerland and Norway is again different. They do not want to become members, but they are so equal in economic and political terms that we decided to just let them participate in all or most aspects of the single market. So they joined. But also with regard to other countries, and Turkey is a very good example, and Tunisia, it's true, there are provisions on free movement, but if you look at the debate, I mean, you mentioned it yourself, they were never implemented. So there has been political resistance from the very beginning to grant free movement to really non-European countries, and that in a way is a tradition which goes back quite a long time. So, but let's move more towards the present. So is the restrictions which we see today, is it to preserve free movement? Or, well, I said earlier that we should, I think, really distinguish the two. I mean, free movement is one reason why the European Union started dealing with migration, asylum, border controls, because Schengen somehow required cooperation on all these fronts. I mean, you cannot have an internal area of free movement, at least not realistically, if you do not agree what to do at the external borders. You need a common visa. So if there is a visa, you can travel freely within the Schengen area. So all that is not a theoretical condition. So you can imagine a free travel area without these polities, but practically speaking, it was a necessity to cooperate on all these issues. So free movement was the reason why the EU started dealing with all these issues. And then there was a really fascinating debate already at the beginning, at the debate which we still have today. It's how open or closed this external border should be. And at the time, and to a certain extent still today, the European Commission in particular is more in favor of free movement. It wants more openness. And that's, of course, the tradition, the pedigree of the single market of free movement. So that's their vision. The EU is about overcoming borders. So let's also do it to a certain extent, at least externally. And then on the other side, you have national interior ministries who usually insist more on restriction. And it was not a coincidence that Schengen was originally a treaty outside the EU framework by a couple of member states only, like-minded member states who had similar views, because they also used Schengen to really promote a restrictionist agenda. And they sidelined at the beginning, at least, the European Commission, the Parliament, the Court of Justice, which in their eyes, the eyes of the member states, were far too much in favor of free movement. So in a way, Schengen was really a tool to really force an alternative and also competing vision onto the European project. And what we have seen in recent years is that this more restrictionist view has really become maybe dominant also in Brussels. I mean, look at the policy debate. It's really very much about restriction nowadays, but that's about external restriction. And that's also, of course, because they want to save the European project and also want to save internal free movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To comment on what you said is that first, when it comes to the integration of non-Europeans into free movements, first of all, eventually the overseas territories of certain member states were integrated into the principle of free movement by the late 1960s. It was done. It was mostly French territories, and as far as Turkey is concerned, it was not clear at the beginning that Turkey would not join. The member states have taken a clear commitment with the Treaty of Ankara that they would apply the free movement of people with Turkey. And you had at the beginning, during this period, if you look at some historical documents of sometimes migration officials in the government, they make typology of origin countries, and sometimes they were mentioning the Turks with other Europeans. So it's more in the 1970s that there was this idea that the commitments we have taken with Turkey, and especially in the early 1980s, that the commitments we have taken with Turkey are not going to be implemented, and Germany was pivotal in this evolution. So it was not.
And I can very much recommend your book on these topics, from which I've actually learned a lot.
thank you. And so that's the first aspect. And then I fully agree with you when you say that once they removed internal border controls, they wanted to have some visibility on who was allowed to cross external borders, especially for chasing criminals and so on. So this, I think, is not a matter of debate. That is, when they had decided to remove, in theory, internal border controls, they needed some cooperation on external borders to prevent criminals from circulating and so on and so forth. But as you as we were discussing, free movement is not just, or it's not even mainly, the fact of not having controls at internal borders. That is, as you mentioned, during COVID, many member states, and actually even today, restored internal border controls. And the UK also always maintained them. It did not prevent those countries from applying the principle of free movement, because you just show your passport or your ID at the border, and that's it. The officials at the borders cannot return you. Why? Because the mere fact of having to show an ID somewhere, it can also happen within national territory. If you want to enter sometimes a museum or an institutional building, you may have to show your ID. So the fact of having to show your ID, and you have to show your ID, of course, whenever you take the plane, even within a country. So the mere fact of having to show an ID document to cross border is not in itself fundamentally incompatible with the principle of free movement. So do we agree on the idea that it was a abolition of internal border controls that made cooperation on third country nationals necessary on migration, but not the core of free movement itself?
Yes, I agree. I fully agree. Okay. Because okay. And that is, I fully agree. And I also agree that, of course, showing a passport is not necessarily, in a legal sense, a hindrance to free movement. But it's, of course, a symbol. It's a symbol that free movement is really more than just an economic activity, but that European states are really forging some sort of common future. So it's really it's about the symbolism of an internal area without border controls, which really I think also the Commission and others have been most interested in. And it's no coincidence that it all started with the presidents of France and Germany agreeing to abolish internal border controls, because it's the symbolism of Franco-German reconciliation after the Second World War, symbolized by Schengen.
Obviously there were other reasons than the symbol. Yes. There were trade reasons. Importantly, Germany wanted to reboost the single market after the restrictive policies, protectionist policies following the 1970s. And so not having any border controls was also a way to ease cross-border traffic and facilitate exports and so on. But so we have agreed on this aspect that a marginal element of free movement, which was more related to free movement as far as symbols are concerned than actual substance is concerned, made cooperation among the member states necessary on third country nationals, but not the core of free movement, which is the right to reside. Yes. And the right to take up employment or start a business. So that's, I think, an important point. So then, after 40 years, let's now come back to today. What is the legal landscape? That is, would you say the EU has developed extensive regulations on how to allocate asylum seekers, how to control external borders, how migrants that cross those borders should be processed, and so on and so forth. So after these developments, what is the landscape of European migration law? If we were to say, what are the big blocks and how do they relate towards one another? That is, the control of migration flows for third country nationals on the one end, the free movement of people for EU citizens or associated like Swiss citizens on the other end. How the two relate to one another? Now, do we have a kind of bicephal migration law in which we have a kind of a bipolar migration law, which has fundamentally two personalities? Would you say they are of equal size now, or free movement is still dominant? That is, if you go to Brussels in an institution and you say migration, are they going to think free movement or are they going to think control?
This is my 700-page book with the 16 chapters, so the landscape is highly complex. And but let me start with the term migration, because you said rightly, I mean, if I go to Brussels and say migration, do they think of free movement? The people in Brussels, especially those in all the EU institutions, would say, no, that's two totally different things, because free movement is for EU citizens, while migration is about these foreigners, these third country nationals, as we call them. So we have really, even at a linguistic level, at least in Brussels, made a very clear distinction between internal free movement of citizens, which the Commission sometimes calls mobility, not migration, and the external migration of foreigners, third country nationals. That is, in the European jargon, also in the EU treaties, now well established. And that was no foregone conclusion. I mean, if you could look at the Brexit referendum and the language used by the British government, they spoke of EU immigration. So they didn't make a distinction because they were also very much against migration. So I think also this language shows you that the EU now distinguishes very clearly between EU citizens and third country nationals. And that in itself is fascinating, because EU citizens nowadays include countries such as Poland, the Czech Republic, Romania, and Bulgaria. And Germany, the country I'm living in, has experienced the net inflow, so more people moving in than out, of more than 2 million EU citizens over the past 10 years. So we had a real mass migration, mainly of workers and others, mainly from Poland, Romania, and Bulgaria. And no one talks about it, hardly anyone talks about it, while the newspapers are full of articles about asylum and foreigners and third country nationals. So at least from a German perspective, I don't know how it is in Greece or France or in all the other member states. It's really this distinction is very well established. And I think it's the same, at least in the core member states, the old member states, Italy, France, they now all distinguish quite clearly between the good free movement of EU citizens and the much more controversial migration of third country nationals. And some people say that is, in a way, even, I mean, problematic, maybe even racist, because the Europeans are white, the foreigners are not white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, as you say, the very terms of the debate have been invested in a certain way. But if we want to define terms, I mean, simply, migration is any movement crossing an international border with the intention of lasting settlement on the other side. So,
if I may, why is migration not moving from Paris to Marseille? Is that also migration?
That's internal displacement. I mean, the notion of migration, but different scholars can have different notions about that. But the way I use it, and I think also many scholars in the field use it, is that migration is fundamentally about the state and about exiting your state and therefore creating a connection between two states, a relationship between two states around the movement of people.
I fully agree, but in Brussels, some people, especially in the European Commission and the European Parliament, I guess, at least among the Euro-friendly political parties, they would say moving from Stockholm to Lisbon is not much different from moving from New York to, let's say, Colorado or Arkansas, or, I mean, in the United States. So in a way, it's just within Europe. It's not a state, of course, at least not in a classic sense, but it's similar. Mm-hmm. What would you say?
Yeah, because U.S. states have also different regulations on many aspects. So there is, some extent, a free movement within the United States, but nevertheless, it's just one state, the way we think of the word state, that is a sovereign authority. So, Bruce, yes.
Emmanuel Macron speaks of European sovereignty.
Yes, but it's not yet. It's not yet on the... it doesn't yet exist, but and yeah, it's a bit provocative, but I am not surprised that many in Brussels believe that it's in the making, because it enhances the status of Brussels as a major power capital, which it is not. The reality is still that states are national, not the EU remains an international organization. But
I find that very fascinating, because if politics in Brussels and also the legal framework which we have for EU citizens is somehow a vision more than a reality, because it presupposes maybe a degree of commonality which in practice does not exist. Let's break it down. I mean, there are some very controversial judgments of the European Court of Justice, to also bring in the more controversial elements, whether a citizen from country X, let's say from Germany, who moves to France, who has not really worked in France, but who is unemployed and then asks for social benefits, whether he, she has the right to receive social benefits in France. And there were some judgments at the beginning which said, yes, he, she has the right. And maybe that was an expression of that vision. It's really a bit like the United States. And more recently, judges have become more careful.
Yes, you mean benefits not related to contributions. Are not talking about his pension, his healthcare. You are talking about, that's an important element. And you know it actually better than me, but in EU migration law, in principle, there is this notion that you should not become a burden for the social assistance of the country of destination. You have full rights to your contributions and they're entitled to, but you should not become a burden. But even if you were to become a burden, and member states would accept that, which is not, I think, judges would have, tell me what you think about that, but judges would have a hard time trying to justify it. It depends on the case, perhaps, but they would have a hard time to justify it. But even if in some cases it can happen, it remains an agreement between between states who accept these terms. But I think on these aspects of the definition of migration, we agree, because I read your book, and so you talk about free movement, even though the book is titled European Migration Law.
Yes, I agree. But I wanted to bring in some controversy, and I still find it fascinating. And social benefits was a very controversial. There were some judgments a few years ago which really forced member states to pay social benefits to people who have never worked in the country, but who were residing there and who were in need. And as many of my colleagues in academia were usually very critical and a bit more left-wing maybe than their governments and very Euro-friendly, They were very disappointed when judges really changed their mind a few years later and said, well, maybe in some situations, if someone has never worked in a country and has no other connection in a some deeper sense, he or she will not receive any social benefits. So that there was a very controversial legal debate.
Yeah, but the negotiations with the member states, as far as I have investigated them, are quite clear. That is, you had countries like Denmark, for instance, and others who say that should not happen. That is,
yeah, but you know, especially that's the magic of the law, that the member states may find out 20 years later that judges interpreted differently than they thought they would interpret it.
But you say judges do not. Eventually, they still stick to the idea that in most
cases, it's always in one way or another, and it's the same in the field of asylum. I mean, we have
the Dano case, for instance, was
Dano, yeah, that was
of this trend. But anyway, so yes, this was the debate: is it migration within the EU? Yes, it is, but because the EU is not a sovereign state, and it remains some rhetoric and some illusion from the Brussels sphere that it is, but it is not. And so, but the question is the EU, and we can conclude on this section on this, is the EU a machine to create free movement or a machine to control the movement of people? In the beginning, in the 1960s, it was clear it was a machine to create free movement. Even though there were limits, it was a machine to create free movement among certain member states. But today, is it still a machine to create free movement, or is it a machine to restrict the movement of people?
I mean, internally it does. I mean, internally, the EU is still very much fostering migration. I mean, Germany would not have experienced the inward migration of more than 2 million, mainly Polish, Romanian, and Bulgarian citizens over the past 10, 15 years without EU law. So in a way, EU law is, yes, it's a machine which produces support, free movement, but we should be careful. Only the free movement of workers and some other privileged people, such as students. We do not have the free movement of people who are, as we discussed, not economically active, as it's usually called in a more legal or technical language. So people who do not work, they do only have a right to free movement if they are rich enough. So
yeah, that is,
let's put it very bluntly, poor Roma, ethnic Roma from Romania or Bulgaria, they do not have a right to free movement unless they find a job.
More specifically, they don't have a right to free movement if they request social assistance in the country of destination. And we'll have the next episode on Romani people with Julia Sardelli soon. So that's...
I will listen to it. Fascinating topic.
In law, those Roma people who are citizens of Romania or Bulgaria, they have the right of free movement. But if they happened, as we were discussing before, to be a burden on the social service of the country of destination, then this is a limit of the free movement. So here, I think, again, we agree that the EU remains more of a machine to create free movement within certain limits than a machine to control the movement of people. I think we agree on that.
For EU citizens, for third country nationals, it's really different, I think.
Yes. But all in all, it's more. And for third country nationals, member states are more than willing to cooperate. They don't need EU support to control. So the distinctive nature of the EU remains of creating free movement among countries that are themselves quite restrictive in terms of migration policies, other things being equal. And you say something which is very true and on which, and I think is very important. You say Germany received millions of people from Poland and other Central and Eastern European countries over the last decades. And you could say something similar with the UK and other European countries, for instance, Spain, Italy, all receive very large numbers of migrants from those. So it depends. In certain countries, you have more migrants coming from inside the EU than from outside. And in the UK, you would consider the UK is traditionally an overseas country, is open to, you have more letters from Australia in the mailbox than from Belgium, supposedly, you know. And even in the UK, while the UK was part of the EU, you had more foreign workers who were EU nationals than were not EU nationals. So you have had very big movements of migration flows within the EU. And as you said, and that is very important, in most cases, we talk about it much less than about third country nationals. So, of course, there were moments in which there were heavy debates about them. So this was the so-called Polish plumber and the posted workers. But my view on that, and you will tell me if you agree, that you had this debate at the beginning when, for instance, Poland joined, when Portugal joined in the 1980s, there were debates as about that. And so, but as time passed by, you have less and less debates. Who now is going to complain about the Polish plumber in 2024? Nobody.
And we are happy if they come because everyone in Poland needs skilled workers. So most plumbers are very much in need.
Perhaps except a few plumbers who disagree that we need them, but I think the overall majority of people would think that. And so that's another element that is actually at the end of the day, you could draw a conclusion that the sustainable policy is free movement, not restrictions. Because once free movement is in place, the debates tend to disappear after a while. Once restrictions are in place, debates keep increasing. What would you say about that?
Well, I mean, the UK is the first obvious counterexample that free movement will not always win, because free movement was a major reason why the population voted for Brexit in 2016, a long time ago, but still it was a big issue. And let's take Germany, because that's the example I know best. And I think the same applies to the Polish plumber in France. I mean, Germany did not open the labor market for Eastern Europe until the early 2010s. So there was a transitional period of a few years where member states could restrict free movement even after accession. And Germany used that transitional period after the enlargement of 2004 to Poland and several other countries. And there was a reason for that. At the time, Germany had 4 million unemployed citizens. So opening the labor market would really have caused the kind of resentment which you just mentioned, the German plumber saying, hey, come on, why is the Polish plumber coming in? Maybe asking their customers a bit less money because they want to succeed in the market. So there is an indirect competition. And that has completely changed over the past 15 years. There was an economic boom. And in that economic boom, it's just now the contrary. German companies are desperately looking for skilled workers, and many of them come from EU member states. I mean, there are currently around 4,000 Romanian doctors working in German hospitals. And that's also a problem, by the way, because these Romanian doctors were trained in Romania at the expense of the Romanian taxpayer who paid for their education. And then they learn German and move to Germany, and they don't have enough workers in Romania. So in a way, I think it really depends also on the context whether free movement becomes controversial or not.
You think it could become again controversial if economic conditions were to change?
Yes and no, because I mean, I do a lot of policy advice, and here in Germany at least. And if you look at demographic projections, I mean, the evolution of the population, you realize that in almost all European countries, with the exception of France mainly, the population is declining massively. So it's really, most European countries are really in need of workers. And since free movement is limited to those who work, not to those who ask for social benefits, it's really a very beneficial free movement, where I think also most politicians and also ordinary citizens understand intuitively that it's useful migration. So I think it's not controversial at the moment, and I don't think it will become very controversial for the reason I just mentioned. Everywhere in Europe, especially in the countries where most people have left over the past years, Poland, Romania, Hungary, and others, they also see a massive population decline in the next 10, 20 years.
For the UK, I mean, let's make a counterfactual, and let's imagine Brexit. There was no Brexit vote in 2016. Today, in 2024, I am almost certain that nobody would care about Polish immigrants in the UK. So it was it's the exception that confirmed the rule, in the sense that it was very polemical at the beginning, especially because, as you mentioned, Germany did not open up to those migrants immediately, while the UK did, and so they received a very large inflow of people comparatively. And so it was polemical at the beginning, but as my intuition is that over time it becomes less and less problematic, because wage standards tend to equalize as people move. And so over time it becomes less problematic. And so it's because it was relatively shortly after. So Germany opened up in 2011. The Brexit vote was 5 years later. So it was still, you know, a little bit there. But I think 2016 was perhaps even the last year in which this issue could be so important in the UK. Perhaps even 2 or 3 years later, it was no longer an issue in the UK. So at least that's my conception of it, that free movement actually is more sustainable than controlled, because people end up on the labor market, they find jobs or they don't find jobs. If they don't find a job, they go back and they can always come back. Whereas restrictions put people in marginality. They work in the black market. They become petty criminals sometimes, and this creates a lot of resentment in the local population. So, and though which want even more controls, and so on and so forth, and it's a vicious circle. But that's my view on it. We don't need to elaborate on it, unless you would like to.
I think for the intra-European context, yes. I think for the extra-European context, like migration in a more narrow sense of third country nationals, I would not agree, because first of all, countries can control immigration. They can never control it fully, of course. It will always happen. But if you really establish very strict restrictions to movement, you can block it. Not internally within the European Union, because we have green borders, and even if we have border controls, and at the moment we have border controls between many member states, you can still get across, because there are only some policemen at some border crossing points, and in between you have forests. So even the border controls we have nowadays between countries such as France and Italy, they are not really very hard controls. It's just symbolic policemen which are visible, which are signaling to the population there is someone on the border, but if you want, you can get across. But that is different for the external borders. For the external borders, I think if you have strict policies, you will never control migration fully, but you will limit and reduce the number of people getting in. And that is maybe even a necessity, because given the immense economic disparities on this world, this immense economic inequality on this planet. I mean, very open borders towards the rest of the world would just not work. At least not in the sense European wanted to work, that they remain rich.
Yeah, just to specify, I'm not meaning open borders. This was the debate we had earlier. You can have border controls to find out criminals and so on. But not allowing people to work, I think, is counterproductive. And you can chase criminals by border controls. I think states have a very hard time in preventing migrants from crossing borders. And we see it every day inside the EU. There are large population of irregular migrants in the UK as well. It's actually very hard to prevent everybody from passing. You can use border controls to find the criminals. Finding normal people becomes a very big burden. And then if you don't give those people a normal status when they are in the country, you end up creating marginals. Anyway,
but what do you think? Let's do a different counterfactual. If Greece tore down the fence which it has built towards Turkey, if Bulgaria opened the fence which it had built towards Turkey, and all the policemen went home and had a nice time with their families, and if Spain,
that's
like
not
abolished
what I am
the
saying.
Fence towards Morocco, would the number of people stay the same who cross?
Oh no, the number of people would increase, that's for sure. Yeah. But I'm not saying to put down the fences. I'm saying that those fences can help track criminals. That's the function of the police, to track criminals. But if you expand the notion of criminality to anyone who moves, then you make your task impossible. So here we differentiate controlling people. And you know, if you enter a stadium, you will be controlled. They may check for your bags. So that's normal.
And whether you have a ticket. And just let me be clear, I'm not defending fences or anything. I'm just trying to understand.
No, but we can defend fences if they fulfill a clear function that is realistic. If they are here to think that you will prevent anybody from crossing, that becomes an illusion. And I think the overall problem of migration in Europe is that mentioning earlier, do we live in reality or in illusions? Yeah, it's an illusion. And so you can have border controls. You can control people to make sure that they are not criminals, they have not been convicted of something and so on. Once people move, giving them the ability to work, to start a business, to go back and forth, is actually the best strategy to avoid having problems with those people. I think that's a lesson we can draw from the European experience. People say, oh, in Europe, migration flows were not so important. That's totally wrong. You had countries like Poland or Romania who had very big migration potential and they were much poorer than the others. So gradualism, you mentioned that there are big disparities in the world today, but gradualism also is the way to address disparities. But anyway, let's not move too far on this topic and stick to European migration law, which is our topic for today. And so we agree that free movement is a major aspect of European migration laws, that the EU is to a very big extent, a machine to create free movement within countries. My last question for you is, do you think nevertheless the EU has contributed to passing some elements of free movement to third country nationals? So that's also a criticism of far-right parties in many countries. They say, oh, the EU is too laxist, and the EU imposes its free movement to many. Is it true? Does the EU really manage to transform policies towards third country national by including some elements of that we would relate to free movement?
Yes, of course it does, but only for a selected group. I mean, there is a term in the interdisciplinary migration literature, which is called bifurcation or stratification. It's that travel across borders is very much dual. On the one hand, you have the bona fide travelers, the good people crossing borders, and states undertake immense efforts to facilitate their movement. We build airports, we have e-gates at external border crossing points where you just have to scan your passport and then the door opens automatically. Your image is scanned by some artificial intelligence or software, and you are then allowed to enter the country. On the other hand, you have Frontex. I mean, you have fences, you have states investing a lot of energy in preventing other people from entering. So it's really this dual world, this two sides of migration law towards third country national, which we have. So tourists, for instance, those who qualify for a visa, rich Saudi families, Americans and others, they can move very easily within Europe, at least for touristic purposes, while for others, it's made very, very difficult to enter the continent and also to move internally. The obvious counterexample or counterpoint are asylum applicants. Asylum applicants, de facto, they move a lot from Greece to Germany, from Italy to Austria and elsewhere. So there is a lot of de facto movement, but de jure, legally speaking, the idea is that they do not move. In practice, they do, because internally in Schengen, it's very difficult to control. But the theory is they do not move. So the idea of European migration law is, it depends on very much in what segments you look into. So my asylum is really restriction, while tourists and also people who are highly qualified, as it's called, to have a university degree, who work, who have a so-called blue card as a highly skilled workers, they can move to other countries generously or at least reasonably easy. So it really depends on whom you look at.
I fully agree with you that states try to facilitate cross-border movements when they sponsor airports or certain e-gates, which are quite expensive material. But I was not necessarily thinking about that, because that actually you don't need the EU to do it. The UK is doing it extensively, for instance. I was more thinking about, what's the core in your book, and that is some legal principles. For instance, at some point in the book, you mention the principle of family unity. That is that you have this principle of family unity, which can allow also some, for instance, I think you mentioned in the book a case in which you have a third country national who is married to an EU citizen, and then they divorce, and so the third country national can stay in the country and nevertheless have, and with their dependents. European migration law can interfere with those rules of family unification. Is it correct? And if so, therefore, do you think that European law contributes to, I will say it very provocatively, opening the gates, as the far right is saying?
For EU citizens, yes, and also for family members of EU citizens who have the passport of a third state who are not EU citizens, including in situations of divorce. But there are lots of judgments, are many legal articles written about them, because it's a fascinating legal development. But in practice, it doesn't really concern so many people.
Yeah.
But I see. European migration law sounds as if it was really a uniform phenomenon, but it's really not. And the example of rich Saudi families who are really invited to come to Europe and to spend their money here, on the one hand, Indian IT specialists who many European countries now want to attract so that they work. So they are really given the, as we say in German, the red carpet. So they are really invited to come to Europe. The rules are getting more and more generous to allow them to enter. And on the other hand, you have mainly asylum, where we have restrictions. So European migration law is not either or, it's really black and white. And in between, of course, then there are many shades of gray, because we all know Frontex, the European Border Controls Agency, and an Indian IT specialist he will never encounter Frontex, but a Syrian refugee or a poor Nigerian trying to reach Europe, they will very much encounter Frontex or national border guards. So it's really European migration law. I mean, at a very abstract level, it's these two worlds. And then, of course, the detail is very much contested. And is also contested with regard to free movement, because, I mean, as I said earlier, member states and the EU, and the member states through the EU, really try to limit the free movement of asylum seekers. But that creates a lot of tensions between member states, because we have a lot of movement de facto. And mainly, I mean, it's very controversial and sensitive, but the majority of asylum applicants, asylum seekers, they do not work. So they are more in the category of EU citizens not working, and they do not find a job. It takes years for them to be economically self-sufficient. I mean, we have lots of German data. So it's in a way a bit like with EU citizens, it's now really mainly positive, and there is only a small minority who creates political tensions, whom we do not allow to move. It's those who do not work, who become a financial burden. But with third country nationals, and it's not only about finances, of course, but this group of people where migration is considered problematic by governments and at least citizens in the sense of how they vote in elections is much bigger. So it's a much more controversial topic. And then it's really not only about the economy. It's also, I mean, you can have discussions about racism, about xenophobia, about what defines our society. So migration is really a fascinating angle to also discuss a lot of really important, crucial questions.
Yeah, and we find this diversity in your book. But to come back to the questions, there are some there is some spillover of European regulation that affects the right of third country nationals to live inside the EU for in cases of marriages and divorces as well. And of course, when there is a divorce after, it makes it even more visible. So there have been some extension to third country nationals. It's not just that European migration law is going to be very liberal towards EU nationals and very restrictive towards third country nationals. No, it's not that. You have an overlap. So independently on the type of migrants concerned, are they affluent or not, some elements related to family unifications are regulated at the European level and limits the capacity of states to restrict the immigration of some third country nationals. So all this, of course, is very topical. And you, Daniel, you have been very much in the news and in demand. I was reading a recent piece of yours, but in Die Welt recently. Oh. So you do you think there is a very big demand of expertise in European migration law today, that it has risen? And how do you respond to it?
Oh, only yesterday I was in the German Ministry of Interior for 8 hours. It was an 8-hour hearing with lots of people working in different ministries and 5 or 6 experts from different disciplines. And it was about this idea, which is now very much promoted by German politicians from different political parties, that we should follow the UK and Italian model of bringing asylum applicants to third states, to a country like Rwanda and Jordania. And whether that was feasible, what are the legal conditions, and whether it's feasible, because it's, I mean, it can be done legally, theoretically, but in practice, it's highly complex. So the demand is massive. And I mean, as you indicated so kindly, migration has really many facets. It deals from economic migration, which is not very controversial, but where also very few people deal with. So economic migration is very important. Very few legal academics at least deal with it. Then we have migration, which is very controversial, which many people with a legal background also do. And we have family reunification. We have border controls. We have visas. So there are all these different facets. We have integration, nationality law. So it's really a fascinating area And I mean, I turned 50 last autumn, so I'm getting old in this field. We have many young people entering it at universities, in academia, in think tanks. So I think it's really a burgeoning, a very dynamic field, which I find fascinating to look at.
Okay, and let's. So you mentioned that we are solicited for to give advice on possible migration practices. Would you say that? So here in that case, where this was a government, huh? You refer to a ministry. Would you say that when those governments request expertise, they have all? Because it seemed to be the case in what you say. Would you say that they have already defined their objective and they just want to have the manner to achieve their objective? Or would you say that at some point you meet in this space officials who are ready to take up ideas about the objectives themselves? Because here you say, oh, we need to have migrants in third countries already and process them in third countries like that, we are fine, they are not going to stay. So it's a restrictive objective. And and they just want to know how are we going to achieve that. Would you say that there is also a demand for expertise to find the objectives? That is to find how on earth are we going to deal with migration? Is there something wrong in what we do?
No, I mean it depends as always. I mean there are this and that scenarios. I mean I really enjoyed yesterday, and that was mainly or partly because it was really an open-ended hearing. I mean they had been given the political mandate by the group of regional prime ministers, which we have in Germany, to look into the issue, and that is what they did. They looked into it. They tried to understand it. They tried to understand the pros and cons, the difficulties, the different possible models you can think of. So yesterday it was really very much a brainstorming, but a very intense brainstorming over 8 hours, I can tell you. So that was very much open-ended. And that was one of the reasons why I found it so terribly exciting and great. In many other instances, it will more be they have formed an opinion and then they, of course, want to look to the experts and listen to the experts. That's usually hearings in parliaments, where I also go quite often. There, the law has already been designed. So you just hear the pros and cons, but the political decisions have been taken. Sometimes you can influence small aspects. I mean, there are some instances where I can show that my expertise has been taken up during the legislative debate and the law has been changed. But by and large, it's this... So it very much depends on the context. And as you said as well, I do a lot with the media. And my impression is that the biggest influence which academics have, if they have any influence at all, I mean, let's be realistic. We are rightly not having too much influence. But the biggest influence we have is that we shape ideas and what people think. So it's not necessarily that we propose solution A or B, but that we change the way people think about certain issues. And then, of course, on that basis, they form their opinion. So we have a very indirect influence. But I think that influence is real. Because I talk a lot to journalists and they don't have much time. So they really depend on me and others advising them, making them understand an area. And of course, there are always different ways to look at an area, different angles to present, different examples to give. So I think that is an influence which we have if we engage in this work.
Yeah, very interesting and very good points. I agree with you. So yes, so I really recommend the book, European Migration Law by Daniel Tain. It's at Oxford University Press, published in 2023. So we have reviewed various aspects of it, focusing on the status of free movement within this this very complex and diverse body of legislation, recognizing that it remains a major aspect of European migration law, and some elements of it have been transferred to third country nationals. So we had also a discussion whether free movement is a more sustainable policy than control. And last, some reflection on how intellectuals and experts can try to influence the way the people think about these questions and the way policymakers try to find solutions when they are confronted with a serious predicament related to human movement and European migration in migration in Europe. So thank you very much, Daniel. Last, would you like to tell us where listeners can follow your work?
Yes. If they speak German, they just have to read the different newspapers and watch television. I'm regularly there. If not, I occasionally write blog posts on the Verfassungsblog, which very much serves an international audience nowadays, but also the Odysseus Network. Odysseus Network, easy term. It's based in Brussels, and it brings together networks on immigration and asylum. I do a lot of work there, also in blog format, including on the new legislation, which will be adopted in the next weeks on asylum, because after 8 years of negotiations, the European Parliament and the Council have finally agreed upon several pieces of legislation to change EU asylum law. That is, of course, very, very important, but I can tell you it's really terribly complex as well. If you add up all the documents, it's more than 800 pages. It's a real nightmare, including for an expert like myself. And it's my ambition, together with other colleagues from Odysseus, to help people like really find a way through this jungle of very complex legislation. And we will do so in a series of blog posts on the Odysseus blog.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you. Have a good day.